Hi, I'm Shanna Bennett, and you're listening to Matter of Life and Death. Today, we're going to be talking about this HarperCollins strike. So fresh off the picket lines, we have Kelly Danver, HarperCollins employee and striker, here to give us all the deets and explain to us how this impacts her student loan debt. Welcome to the podcast. Hey, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined today by Emma, one of our producers.
Hi, everyone.
So, Emma, how do we know Kelly?
So, I am friends with one of Kelly's colleagues, also in the HarperCollins Union, who is on strike. And I've been following the strike's progression in the Times, on Instagram, all of the social media that your union is putting out. And Kelly, I saw you talking on Instagram about what you would do with a pay raise. And it's sad, but obviously reality, that one of those things you would do with it is pay off your student loans faster. So that inspired us to reach out to you and talk to you today.
Absolutely. Yeah. How that came about was Carly, who was filming a lot of the Instagram stuff for that day, asked if I would record a little phrase or saying of what I would spend the extra money that we would get out of this fair contract. And I don't think this is something that a lot of people think, but I'm sure some people do, that when we're striking and asking for more money, that we're asking for it for luxurious purposes. And I think across the board, what you're going to find is people just want to live a little bit more comfortably. And for me, for the past, I'd say 8 years that I've been in New York, six and a half of those being in publishing, student loans was always something that would maybe go away someday, but it's always going to be a payment that has to be made as much as rent is going to have to be made. And knowing that rent plus student loans is a full paycheck gone for most people out of the two that they get per month. After that, you have one paycheck to kind of cover everything else. And I'm not sure a lot of people understand quite how many of us do really live paycheck to paycheck in that way, not really saving if something terrible were to happen. A lot of us don't have much financial recourse beyond potentially our families. And that's where some of the diversity and inclusion initiatives that we're talking about ties in. So a lot of this is, as we know, all tied up together into one messy bundle.
Well, we heard that you wanted to be able to handle your student loans in a different way by getting more pay. You realized, okay, this is up our alley. Let's learn more about what's going on, because I feel like there's a lot more conversations around striking in the student debt world and what can be achieved through unionizing and also striking. Can you tell us a little about what are some of the demands? How do we get here?
Essentially all of 2022, the first half, January, February, March, April, we were extending our contract, trying to negotiate with HarperCollins. And by April, we were essentially working without a contract, the one that we'd previously had expired, and Harper was not coming to the table to bargain. We then took a series of steps from April. Back in July, we had a one-day strike where we chose a day during one of our more busy times during the year to kind of demonstrate to management that we were very serious about what we were asking for and that they would potentially miss us if we stopped working. That didn't necessarily produce the results immediately what we were looking for, but we knew that we just had to keep going. And as it got further along into the year, we were just realizing that management in general wasn't going to meet us at the table for a lot of this, for these conversations. And because of that, our chapter decided to hold a vote for a strike. We voted in favor to do it. And that week of election week, we were initially going to do that on the Monday, but we were like, Monday is happening. Let's kind of give people a chance to vote and kind of get that out of the way. But then November 10th, not having a bargaining session on the calendar with management and them not reaching out and asking for one, we initiated the strike. And overall, what we're asking for, in terms of financially, what we're asking for is higher minimums for starting salaries for entry-level employees. We are below average Harper is across a lot of different publishing jobs. Penguin Random House, who is a comparative corporation that we compare a lot of our business across with, on average has higher salaries than most HarperCollins employees. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is with the minimums being where they are, that's just the baseline where we can start. And talking about those numbers, we're really talking about what is determined to be a livable wage in New York City, which right now is $52,000 a year. And Harper doesn't think that that is something that they need to offer. So financially, that's where we are at. But we're also asking for better initiatives on diversity and inclusion. During 2020, when a lot of these conversations were happening, a lot of corporations really needed to take a look at how they viewed diversity and inclusion, what their workforce looked like, what they needed for support, what they needed for resources. And we in our Harper Union knew that if we could really hold the company accountable on some of these initiatives that they talked about, we could make this a more inclusive and diverse place to work. And we also asked for some union protections as well. Sometimes what people get confused about is that there are absolutely things that are in New York state law that are in our union contract. And some people would think that is redundant, but if it's in our union contract, even if the New York laws change, it's still upheld in our union contract. And as we know, laws change all the time. We've been experiencing that a lot this year in 2022. So us asking for some of those stronger protections is to ensure that we are as representative of the HarperCollins employee pool as we can be. So yeah, those are our demands.
Seems pretty simple and straightforward. Is this a younger union? Do you know when this came to be? Because I think HarperCollins has the only union across the...
The only union, the Big Five. Right. Yes. It is an 80-year-old union.
Got it.
And this is not the first time the union has gone on strike. Harper and Row, which is one of the previous iterations of HarperCollins, their workers went on strike. So it's under UAW. It's under skilled labor. A lot of our union represents entry-level employees, support staff, production editors, copy editors, you name it. There's some marketing associates. I'm a senior sales support associate. One thing I've actually been kind of really surprised by is I'm a 5-year employee of HarperCollins. Yeah, it's been a while. But a lot of the people I've met on the picket line have been working there some 5 months, some 8 months, some 1.5 years. And one of the things we're really kind of trying to address is the amount of turnover that happens in publishing. People get burned out, overworked, and all of that while they're underpaid means that a lot of these positions turn over a lot. I mean, just thinking about it, I remember I worked a lot with marketing. Well, in general, I still work a lot with marketing, but kind of growing up in this position and in HarperCollins, there are definitely like 2 or 3 different people in certain roles when I was staying in my one. So it can be for some just like a kind of intense environment, but some people really thrive in that too. So there's a balance that we can strike and we're certainly trying.
I noticed you said the livable wage for New York is like 52, but I read that it was asking to raise the entry level wage from 45 to 50. So it's not even the 52.
I mean, what we try to present to Harper management in general is what we really see is something that is fair to ask for and what we deserve as employees of this corporation. We think that overall, there's a lot of really important work done at the foundation. I don't want to discredit what leaders of a business can do. I think there are some who are really good at steering a company through hard times, through hardships, but I think to discredit the working body that kind of keeps that engine running while you're trying to navigate throughout these dangerous capitalist waters that we have, it would be remiss to kind of forget about them. And I think a lot of us feel that we are kind of a cog in the capitalist machine and that we are replaceable, when in reality, our institutional knowledge is so important for our positions. Overall, what is a little bit hard to explain within publishing is that some people really don't understand how a book gets into their hands. We have an army of people who are creating these books and getting them into bookstores. It takes, so once you start taking some of those important pieces out of that train, it's going to go off the rails.
Kelly, do you have a sense of when the strike will really start to hurt HarperCollins that all of you are not working?
I've definitely heard from some people inside. And overall, I think the reason why we're in between a rock and a hard place is that there is a little bit of a cognitive dissonance between what the management, the people team high up at HarperCollins feel or how they interact with the company versus our personal experience. Honestly, that means that some of that gap is going to have to be bridged by probably more conversations within their internal departments, understanding how their individual managers' teams are operating. So, I mean, as far as it hurting HarperCollins in general, who's to say? But I do know that my personal experience, I do know there were certain things that I only knew how to do. Harper does not have a corporate training structure in the way, I mean, we all train each other. That's part of like the turnover is that that's knowledge passed down. And so we had a potentially message that they were hiring temps, but we don't know really who would train those temps because it would have been us. I can't speak to how it is operating inside, but I do know a lot of us hold the keys to certain palaces.
It's interesting. So they're not coming to the table, but I read today that they've raised entry-level wages. They've offered merit-based increases. They haven't come to the table, but they've done some of these things.
I'm not part of the bargaining committee, so I can't necessarily speak to anything that's changed fairly recently. What I will say is that there is definitely options to get merit raises within Harper. I've absolutely received a merit raise in my time there. They have also raised their minimums in the last 5 years in general, overall. But these raises do not keep up with inflation, do not keep up with the cost of living in New York, and are also still widely under average across publishing in general. So it's kind of like saying I grew 3 inches over the summer, but when you're already like 7 feet tall, like what's 3 inches, right? What they're saying is technically true, but not in the spirit of what we're asking. One of the reasons why we're asking for bigger differences too between what their minimums are and what we're asking for is that we think that this really needs to reflect actual change and be meaningful in their raises. A 1% raise can be an extra $25 a month, which helps, but it's not meaningful. And it doesn't really add to the amount of interest that we're paying on these loans, as I was mentioning before, or any of the higher costs. It's not our fault that there's a lot of economic disruption happening now. So we shouldn't really have to pay for it.
With an established union, there's this slow approach to coming to the table and hammering this out. Like, I'm not quite sure why you're on day 9, especially for a union that's representing what, like 250 employees?
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit untenable. I've been saying for a CEO is always going to be prepared for frank conversations with his employees about money. So arguably, either they don't want to come to the table and don't want to bargain with us. Maybe they don't know how, or they don't know what or how to balance this budget. They don't know how they're going to both do what they want and be flexible, but also make sure that their employees are earning a livable wage, which doesn't necessarily give me a lot of faith in who's navigating the ship. But overall, it's something that we've seen probably the last 6-7 months since April, since we've been working without a contract, is that they are choosing to not meet with us, to not have these conversations. We've been wanting to have them for a long time. And what their motives are behind that, for me, it just doesn't spell out anything good.
Kelly, can you give us some background into your personal experience with student loans? How has that impacted your career choices, your career in publishing? What has been your experience with student loans personally?
Overall, my relationship with my loans has always been kind of this shadowy thing in the corner that kind of just shames me, just in the sense that there's a lot of things that I want to do in this life, and I want to be able to also buy the things or hold the things that bring me joy. And I would also like to be able to have a little bit of a cushion just in case something were to happen, or I would get an opportunity that would mean I would need to take time off from work in some way. None of these things have ever really been possible, or at least not in the triangle of what I would like to have, of having all three. It's always a matter of sacrifice. Either I'm wearing the same shoes for a whole year, even though they've got holes in them and they make my socks wet when it rains, or am not able to go to a friend's wedding or visit them or spend time outside of the city, or I'm doing all of those things and eating ramen or for the last 3 days before my paycheck comes in, or God forbid something were to happen, hit by a car, like fall down the stairs, any of those things could happen and I could be out of work with no money in my savings account. And all of these things are just basic human things that we want and human desires and rights to have. And so having student loans and rent and having those two things tied together, and almost always from the time I've been in publishing being a whole paycheck's worth of bills and things that I have to pay, just meant that during this whole time, it's always been a growing of sacrifice. And in the last like 5 years, I have gotten to a place where I feel much better about where I am. But with the rise of inflation and cost of living in general, even though I'm getting there, it's still catching up. And I can never quite make that distance any larger than, say, a couple months. When student loans were paused during the pandemic, it was kind of life-changing for my finances. I was able to finally save money in a way that I had never had before, to the point where I have three different loans. One's about $20,000, one's about $10,000, and then one was about, weirdly, it was a really small one. It was like $700. I didn't really break that down, but the government seemed to think it was a good idea. But that $700 loan, I was actually able to pay off during the pandemic because of the money that I was able to save, because I wasn't made to pay a lot. I wasn't really paying for anything, let's be real. But that, to me, was just this big sigh of relief of not having this one little piece of it that I had to worry about anymore. It's still $29,000 that is just kind of sitting there that I'm not sure will go down at all, but it's always going to be there. So I always kind of have to think about it. And I was recently on the picket line and I had an old friend come and visit who's bounced around a couple different jobs in publishing. She worked for Penguin Random House and then the National Book Awards, and then is now, I think, working for the San Antonio Book Fair. But in between that, she was working for a nonprofit and did some other non-publishing things. And because of the salaries from those other jobs, she was able to pay off her loans in a much faster way than I was. It's definitely something I've always thought about. Publishing was what I wanted to do. And being within that community has always been a source of joy for me, but it shouldn't be at the expense of my financial needs.
When you feel that burden of student loans and you see like a friend take a job perhaps that pays more, I mean, have you contemplated that, taking a job to pay this down?
100%. Yeah. I come from a liberal arts background. I was a history major. And so what happened was I was in D.C. I grew up right outside of it in Alexandria, Virginia. My mom was working for George Washington University. So when I was accepted, I would actually get a discount because she was working there. So this private school education suddenly became the cost of a public school education. Close to my house, I was able to do laundry on Fridays. I was like, hell yeah, let's do it. After 4 years there, and I had grown up around this place, I was like, I'm kind of done. And in having the privilege of having a grandmother who had very much saved a lot of her money, she had left me $10,000. And so I used that to move up to New York without a job, because I was like, I want this publishing situation. I want to be in it, or I want to at least try. I didn't have any sort of, beyond working at the GW magazine and my degree and a couple of other little internships, I didn't really have much on my resume, but I had gumption. I was like, I'm going to New York. I can do this. It took a full year to find a job in publishing. And in that, I had two unpaid internships, which were absolutely, in 2017, still okay within the industry, is to have these unpaid internships. I don't think you're going to find too many now, but it was still something that a lot of places. And I got a job at an agency, WME, which is a pretty well-known big agency. And they hired me at $10 an hour to work from 9 to 7, which was really like 9 to 8. And from there, I was just really happy to finally have a job. And I was logging logging my hours, like I think that ended up being maybe like $30,000 a year. So just being hired at that. And I think WME in general kind of saw themselves as a graduate media university kind of thing, even though they're an agency and that's a full-time job. They didn't really see it as a problem. I think what a lot of media and publishing companies kind of see is that if you make it big, and it's a glamorous job. So you kind of have to stick around and do these kind of small-time potato roles with meager cash, just kind of waiting for your, which doesn't really create a workforce that wants to stay there or feels like they have a lot to give because they do feel replaceable. And so getting out of that job, I found the job at HarperCollins, and that's been where I've been for the last 5 years. And I'm very lucky to have the manager that I have. He's been a mentor to me. He's looked out for me, but he's also made sure that he can incentivize me to stay financially. And he stated as such. He knows that it's a lower paying industry, and he knows that he wants me to stick around. And part of that is making sure that I have money, or at least have the money that he feels that he can give me at the time, and that I feel like I'm working towards a future within the industry. And not everybody has that. Not everybody has somebody who's willing to go to bat with them with when it comes around to merit raises, when it comes to those one-time bonuses that very few and far between pop up. And because it's so arbitrary across the board, especially at HarperCollins, and since we know that we have the opportunity to affect the change in our union contract, there's no way we could turn down that opportunity.
So while striking, are you earning a paycheck right now?
We are not earning a paycheck. I think our last paycheck was last Thursday, which covered the few days that we weren't on strike the week before. And now I don't believe we are going to be receiving any funds during this time. I certainly haven't received anything.
Do you get funds from do you have a union fund?
The union has strike funds. So that's definitely money that a lot of us have. And we do have our own strike solidarity fund and a hardship fund. So we're making sure that we're looking after some of our most vulnerable members who are still standing in solidarity with us. So making sure that they have what they need. Like I said, I'm very privileged, very lucky. I have a family who can absolutely help me out if I need it. But not everybody has that. And that's really the heartbreaking side of this, is that I'm struggling, but I have all of these safety nets to help me. Imagine somebody who doesn't have what I have, or had to take out more loans for their education, or felt they needed that master's degree, or needed a publishing course to get a better edge in getting into this industry. Like I said, it took me a year and I didn't have any of that. So for somebody who really wants this even more, or wants a different end of it, editing is probably one of the hardest jobs to get into in this industry. Lord knows I tried to get editorial assistant positions. Never once got close. So it's like, these are highly sought after positions, and they take a lot of talent and a lot of resume building to get noticed for. And without some of these things, we're required to have a bachelor's degree. We're required to have some of these unpaid internships. That shuts a lot of people out. And for a company, as we've said, that wants to commit itself to diversity and inclusion, that starts with being able to welcome people who might not have had access to this industry to begin with.
Kelly, do you see diversity in your leadership? Do you think that's part of kind of the stalemate?
Absolutely. It's a problem. There's a lot of women in publishing, but there's a lot of white women in publishing. And I think another thing to understand about the industry is that one of the reasons why we're calling for so much diversity is that it used to be a lot of white women editors buying white women written. And that does not create a bookshelf that is diverse or inclusive or has a different points of view. A guy from LA is going to think differently from a guy from the Bronx, or a guy from Detroit, or a guy from Tampa. And so having those different points of view, especially when it comes to character tropes, character driving forces, plot driving forces, making sure that it's obviously not racist, ableist, or insults a marginalized community, but also feels authentic, feels like it is a lived-in story. Some of the best ones are books about a place or a place and time within or around the world. But if you have somebody who's never lived that experience trying to edit your book, they're not going to get it. And they're going to make bad suggestions. And the book isn't going to be as strong as it can be. But it's not just editing the book. It's marketing the book. It's booking publicity. It's selling it to booksellers and getting it into the stores. This has to have a place of talking about these different points of view without it having to be broken down so that it can be digested by everybody. We print so many books. Not every book has to be for everybody, but we certainly have to try and find as many different points of view as we can. And more people are going to come to the table then. More people are going to be buying books. And that's our whole thing, is we got to get people to buy books. And we can do that by printing all different kinds of them.
And why not expand the audience who wants to buy your book?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I like that you made the point about kind of gaining entry into this world and that a bachelor's degree is a part of that. I think when it comes, you know, back to student debt, part of that debate is that we had other options. And I think depending on your career path and what you're trying to achieve, sometimes there is no other option but higher education. And if you can't afford that, you end up taking out a loan. So to your point, you're taking out this loan, but then you're having to jump through these hoops that require you to work without getting paid for extended period. And so that issue as well. So I appreciate you making that point.
It's changed so much. And I think that's also what we're having. I think maybe even Harper management's having some whiplash about it, because I will say, like 10 years ago, I mean, it's gotten a little bit better now. I think even Penguin Random House, again, is now no longer requiring bachelor degrees for their positions. That's fairly new. 10 years ago, when I was starting out, that was across the board a requirement on any of their job postings. For a lot of them, they still are. And as you said, taking out loans can be a requirement for people to get that. There's also these publishing institutes I've been talking about. Essentially, what those are is they're certificate programs where you go and you get to learn about different parts, different departments, marketing, publicity, sales, editorial. You also learn like the difference between magazine publishing and book publishing and even digital publishing. And big wigs from the industry come and talk to you and you get to network. And it's certainly, it can be an absolute fantastic experience for some people. But for some, they add it to their resume, but then nothing necessarily happens. And those institutes cost money. So that's another thing that you may feel like you need to get to give you an edge, but then it ends up not really helping at all.
Do you know people who've taken out student loans for those institutes?
I don't know if they've taken out student loans for those institutes, but I do know certainly people who have had to ask for funds to help pay for those. They couldn't necessarily take it out of pocket. So it might, I don't know if it would be a student loan per se, but it certainly was a loan of some kind. And so it can be really beneficial. But it also is then something else that you have to pay for down the line with your salary increasing to 10% over 20 years that you're there, which is crazy.
Did your debt ever deter you from striking or from participating in the union at all?
It never made me not want to participate. It is something, I think, again, we're a bit at a lucky time right now, if only because they do seem to still keep pausing these payments until they really figure out what the heck they're doing with this, because they're very much dragging us around on
extended another 6 months.
Yes. So. But honestly, that's a saving grace that had that not been implemented right now, I still think I would have done it. I still think most of us would have done it, but I'd be in much more dire straits. And I think that, again, it's despite the fact that I've definitely gotten probably more raises than your average person at Harper over these last 5 years that I've been there, I'm still looking at a future where my rent and my student loan payments are one paycheck that is just gone. And with the rising prices and inflation and just cost of living in New York in general, it's, again, just another year of like, what can I sacrifice to make this work?
I think it's interesting that the other major publishing houses aren't unionized, because I think that when it comes to a strike like this, it can be precedent setting or it can spread.
To that point, that's absolutely one of the reasons why we feel like it really is an opportunity that we need to take advantage of. And this is something why I think Harper doesn't quite realize that if they were to set these minimums, the entire industry would have to start to meet them. Because at that point, again, it's untenable to see that big publishing houses offering this and that another place can't. And so we do think that overall, it's going to affect change in every corner of it. And so to not, one, ask what we're worth and ask for a fair contract, it's also so important to have that to be an example for the rest of the industry, especially places that aren't unionized. I feel lucky that 80 years ago, the workers at HarperCollins understood the importance of it. Because unions gave us weekends. Unions mean you have to be a certain age to work. Unions gave us 9 to 5s. People died to give us these rights. And so it is, I think, rude to think that our union is something that is trying to get any sort of serious thing out of this. We are asking for things that are fair and right. And what we're doing is the right thing to do.
I also thought it was interesting that you were talking about how these, just to reiterate, you're not asking for luxurious things. And even listening to you anticipating what a pay change might mean for you and putting that those extra funds towards student loans. It's fascinating because when we talk about debt and student loans, oftentimes it's this caricature of these people who are just wanting this money to spend frivolously on these things. I have not heard one person yet that has these frivolous ideas of how they want to spend this money. And I think that's important to highlight also.
Yeah, I think overall our demands really are to have a more comfortable lifestyle in the sense that we don't have anxiety about what's going to come next. Sure, it would be nice to take a nice vacation, but not at the expense of not paying my bills or not having the opportunity to purchase something that my home needs. So it's not as if we're living in this place of squalor, certainly not, but we are living in a place that is tedious and hard to plan for. I don't really look to the future as much. Part of that's a little bit my personality, but also it's hard to plan 5 years from now when you're not sure that you're going to be making much more than you do. The idea of me buying a house anywhere around here is frankly ludicrous, but this is where the industry is. This is where the job is. And unless they decide to ever go fully remote, people who work here are going to have to live here. And if that's the case, they have to make it so our living here isn't going to make us fully in debt for the rest of our lives, or make it so that we possibly can't get the assistance that we need, either medically, financially, emotionally.
I mean, this is a really obvious statement, but what I love about your participation in the union and the organization that you and your colleagues have is I used to work in nonprofits and also very low wages that kind of left you unable to advocate for yourself or ask for anything really, and leaves you in, like you're describing, a precarious financial situation always, where you can't leave a situation if you want to because you have nothing to fall back on. But I mean, what's incredible is even though you do feel all these things because you have the support and solidarity of the union or some funds built up from your union dues or other sources of fundraising that the union has, this is the incredible thing that you can put yourselves out there to a large degree. And it's wildly impressive and inspiring to see how striking works in this way. It's so awesome.
Yeah. Democracy in action. Absolutely. It's been really enlightening being kind of going through this process. I really truly never thought we'd get here. And it's heartbreaking. And let's be frank, it's kind of humiliating in a sense. They're requiring us to beg in a way. And every day we're out there, a lot of people are supportive. We do get some hecklers or even just staring at us like, what are you doing? And that can weigh on a person. And the walking, the steps, I mean, physically, spiritually, mentally, this has been a tough time to be a HarperCollins employee, even with management inside. I know the kind of work we did, so I'm sure they aren't pleased with the setup that we have going on. But as you said, it's been so emboldening and validating to be with coworkers on the picket line and hearing stories. Even just the other day, I heard this girl talking about her experience with her manager, and it's the same kind of bad experience I'd heard about for the past two employees that have been around there. And the cycle still seems to keep moving and not breaking, but being able to talk with each employees and know that it's like, no, we're not crazy. Yes, we're doing the right thing. Yes, these are reasonable asks. Reminding each other that day in and day out, why we're out here, what's at stake.
what we can accomplish, all super helpful. So as hard as all of this has been, I'm cautiously optimistic. And I mean, it's really tough now, but knowing that if we do manage to pull this off, it's going to be huge.
Mm-hmm. Especially because the strike is indefinite right now, right? It's indefinite.
Yeah. When I signed off, I was sending my boss one last email and I was just like, I don't know. I literally have no idea. But as of tomorrow, I will not be working. Thanks for the memories. It could last well into December. It could last into January. It really depends on if they're willing to come to the bargaining table.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think to offer, I guess, words of encouragement, just a reminder that the group, the Debt Collective, that we often work with, they've seen incredible success by using striking as a form of political protest, economic protest, specifically for a lot of the for-profit schools, ITT Tech and Corinthian colleges. We've seen that wiped away from students saying, no, this is unjust debt. This is an unjust process. And so it's completely possible. We've seen it happen before. So I think our hope is that this comes to the table with you guys and actually has a legitimate conversation.
Yeah. I'm sure a tactic on their side is to not meet with us, but that's why we felt that we had to strike, is because as serious as they seem to be about their demands, we are just as serious. And we think our work is more important to their day-to-day than they may realize. And just to mention some of those, yeah, exactly. Just to mention some of those other strikes that are going on, the 10,000 workers down in California, student aid, teachers, worker, they arguably earn even less than us. And so what I'm really kind of seeing across the board is that I think society sometimes takes our cultural gifts like books, museums, professors, people who write or study culture or contribute to it in that way. We tend to write these positions off and potentially think that they aren't worth what they are. But a society without art and culture is not a society. And somebody has to do these jobs. Somebody has to do them. We've established that they are critical to what we do day to day. That's why we created them. That's why we put people in them. And if that's the case, then you gotta pay us.
Exactly. So next steps are just striking indefinitely, basically, until there's change, right?
Yeah. Overall, if this does go into January, it's going to be one of those things where we are absolutely using our social media to try and get people to donate to our strike fund, get people to continue to write to the people team at HarperCollins. It is so important for us to keep the pressure on management to make sure that they understand that, again, we are serious. We do not want to fold. We are not planning to fold. It is not in our nature. And so hopefully they understand that sooner rather than later. You know, down the line, we can always check back in. But I think right now it's really about holding the line and making sure that they understand it as best they can, that we believe in this contract and we do think it's going to make Harper a better place.
Kelly, where can our listeners follow the progression of the strike and support your union?
Sure. I believe the social media handles are HCP Union, HarperCollins Publishers Union. So it's HCP Union. Instagram, Twitter are probably our main avenues for getting information about what's happening within the union. If anything changes, that's probably where it's going to be. It also gives people some do's and don'ts on how to interact with us, how to express yourselves to HarperCollins should you want to. It also gives a little bit of information about us, our demands, overall, who we are as a union, why we're doing this, what we're trying to represent, and anything in between.
Great. We'll absolutely share that with this episode.
Else in closing?
I think just to reiterate, student loans are always going to probably be a part of me, unless hopefully the Supreme Court upholds Biden's plan to cancel at least $10,000 for most folks. And just a reminder that I'm a very privileged person in this industry. So if I'm struggling, there's a lot of people who are not in the position that I am that need some of this debt relief even more than I do. And so when you see us striking, know that a lot of us are out there because we know we deserve this and it's something that is going to make everybody's lives better. So yeah, that's us in a nutshell. We're trying to make HarperCollins lives better.
We appreciate you stopping by and sharing your story with us. I think
one of the important things too is that folks continue to hear different stories, how debt is affecting different people, because I think it just shows that we're all not having the same experience. And it offers more for folks to connect with and kind of understand some of the challenges that come with debt. So we appreciate your time. Thanks for stopping by.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys so much. Pleasure to talk to you.
All right.
If you like this episode of Matter of Life and Debt, subscribe and share it with a friend. It really helps people discover us. Matter of Life and Debt is hosted by me, Shanna Bennett, and Emma Klauber, and created by Nikki Nolan. It is produced by Emma Klauber, Nikki Nolan, Talia Malay, and Shanna Bennett. It is edited by Talia Malay and Nikki Nolan. Transcripts and social media writing is done by Emma Klauber. Our theme music was created by F.A. Achman. Visit our website, matteroflifeanddebt.com, where you can listen to more episodes, access transcripts, and get additional context for the subjects you just heard about. Absolutely for free. The website again, matteroflifeanddebt.com. Thanks again for listening.